Welcome to the People Who Read People podcast with me, Zach Elwood. You can learn more about it and sign up for a premium subscription at peoplewhoreadpeople.com. On this episode, I talk to Brian Koppelman, who you may know as the writer of the poker movie Rounders and the creator and writer of a bunch of other shows and movies, including the show Billions and the recent series about Uber called Super Pumped. Brian also has his own podcast called The Moment, and he's interviewed a ton of interesting people, including celebrities, TV and movie writers and creators, and quite a few poker players. One reason I wanted to talk to Brian is because I once, years ago, wrote a blog post about other poker tells and rounders besides the obvious Oreo cookie tell. Basically, some of the things the characters said during the hands mapped over to common verbal patterns that I've written about in my poker books. You can find that blog post of mine on readingpokertells.com or by searching online for the phrase more poker tells in rounders. You might enjoy checking that out before listening to the episode, actually. So I wanted to ask Brian about that stuff and more. Other topics Brian and I talk about are what led him to working on rounders, his childhood interest in poker, his interest in behavioral clues, which I've found seem to feature pretty prominently in his work, the difficulties of reading and interpreting behavior in real-world situations, the potential meanings of someone wearing an old full-tilt poker hat, the downsides of being too confident and thinking you can read people, why you should watch David Mamet's movie House of Games, his interest in transcendental meditation and the benefits he's found from that, and his thoughts on what it takes to conduct a good interview. You can follow Brian on Instagram at Brian Koppelman. His website is at briankoppelman.com. Okay, here's the talk with Brian Koppelman. Hey, Brian, thanks for joining me.
It's my pleasure to be here with you. As I've mentioned to you, I've read your stuff, and I find it fascinating, compelling, useful.
Thanks, Brian. It's a big honor for you to say that and for you to join me, so I'm excited. Maybe we can start with, I've watched, you know, a good amount of your stuff, including Rounders and Billions, and I watched the Uber show recently, Super Pumped. And I noticed, I could be imagining it, but it seemed like there was a theme of reading people that was above average in your work. You know, for example, in Billions, you had several instances of Mason getting reads on people and these kinds of things. And some of those clips I uploaded to social media because I found them fun and interesting. Am I right that in sensing that you've had a long time interest in people's behavior and finding clues in people's behavior?
I loved when you put that stuff up on Instagram or wherever else I came across it, because it's always fun, but more than that, like rewarding when someone who's sort of a domain expert picks up on something that you're doing, and a domain expert whose work you're aware of. And so for me, that was super cool. It was like, yeah. And for David, when I say me, I'm always talking about David Levine as well, my partner, in doing this stuff. Because when I say we think about things like domain experts, you know, you're not making the show, you're not making the piece of art for people who are experts in whichever particular domain might surface. But you are aware of the fact that we are aware of the fact that if we can get it right in a way that those people notice, then it's possible that something about the authenticity of that will land for people who just instinctively understand it. Because, you know, a lot of that stuff, you know, we go through our lives, whether we're aware of it or not. And in a way, you know, in a way, at the beginning, you're at a disadvantage, I think, if you are, okay, I can read people, I am now going to pay attention. In a way, that takes you out of the thing we do as human beings, which is absorb information, process and synthesize that information and come out with our own behavior, right? And so we can get better at that through conscious work, for sure. But we all do it to varying degrees of excellence or non-excellence. And I do think we've always been interested in it. I think as a human, when you start to realize that verbal exchange, that's great too, we can talk about verbal exchange. When you start to realize that people don't always, A, they don't always know what they mean. B, they don't always say what they mean. Sometimes they say something close to what they mean, but really what they're doing is saying something because there's an end they want to get to. And when you start to realize that there's information and there's disinformation, I think it's useful, or we realize at a certain point, it's useful to try to open yourself up to be able to apprehend what's really going on. And our work features that because we like to write about characters smarter than we are, more attuned than we are. And those kinds of people have the ability to recognize these micro moments. And I would say, as you are, without doubt, David and I are people who read Mike Caro's work super closely 30 years ago. And, you know, the Book of Tells began a conversation for us. I mean, really, it began watching the movies, like, you know, con artist movies and reading about cons and reading about lying and the way people can catch liars. But then Mike Caro codified in, again, I know an earlier way, or a way that maybe hasn't been as tested or scientific at the time, but, you know, there are certain foundational things Caro talks about, like first divine whether somebody's aware of the fact that they might be able to reveal themselves. Okay, if they know that, do they think you're the kind of person who would know people reveal themselves? Okay, do they think you're watching closely? If they do think you're watching closely, are they going to try to give you a false signal? And like all that stuff when we were young was so fascinating. And also the questions that it raises, right? The work raises these amazing questions, because I can distinctly remember the first time I was playing, and the first like window of time I was playing in high stakes for me, No Limit games. And there's this one hand that's haunted me, because the person I was who was in a hand with was a really dramatic, very high strung dude. He wasn't intentionally trying to use stuff in Book of Tells to throw me off. And he made a giant bet, and he did a very dramatic look in my eyes. And I knew from Caro that he was bluffing, but I hadn't yet internalized it. So I knew, and it was this terrible moment for me, because, and I'm sure you've had this in the beginning of figuring all this stuff out, it was like being a sociologist in a way, but not being able to master myself, because he makes an all-in bet. My ego's on the line. It's late at night. It's way before rounders. It's just the beginning of figuring all this stuff out. And he puts me all in. Back then we'd say tap, you know, he taps me. And I said, I look, and he does this dramatic, like almost puts his face right in front of mine. And I said, I know, fuck, the book says you gotta call. He's bluffing. But I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it. And I folded, and he showed the bluff. And it was this amazing moment of, no, you got to actually do the work now to internalize it, to incorporate it. You have to play this out if you're going to engage with this stuff. And it's one of those things. And you know, you say this in, when you talk about the verbal tells, Zachary, in one of your books, most of the time you come up empty. It's a lot of trawling and there's nothing there. And that's also important to recognize the other side of it, right? Not to fool yourself into believing that you're hearing or seeing something that's not there. Or you're picking up on a subtle piece, but you know what? I don't actually have certainty here. Maybe it now takes me from 54% to 55. That's not enough to really shift my behavior. Mm-hmm. I'm an amateur, but I find it incredibly fascinating and compelling. And it certainly makes sitting in a meeting or in a poker game that much more compelling, right? Mm-hmm. And that's why it finds its way into the work, I think.
Now, was that interest in, because I think it does get to the crux of drama. Some of these, you're talking about like the Caro things of, you know, somebody implies they're strong and they'll be, you know, more likely to be weak, or somebody implies they're weak, they're more likely to be strong. It is such a crux of like narrative drama, fictional drama of people, you know, giving false signals about what they want to other people, you know, and I was curious if that, Which came first, if it's possible to say, was it that aspect of poker, like the, you know, the deceiving other people, did that really interest you from a, you know, a fundamental narrative and drama perspective? Was that part of what drew you around?
But I mean, one of the things is like, who can find their way to the truth? I would say it's not like about the it's not as much about the deception. It's about like deciphering who is able to see clearly, right? A hero, who's a hero who can see clearly what's going on in the world? Mm-hmm. Because don't we want to be, you know, we all want to think as human beings that we can walk into a room and understand the dynamics.
Right, the dream.
But if you put three people in a room, right, but if you put three people in a room, there's no way you can understand the dynamics. Like, this is not a political statement, but like Barack Obama as a human, forget him politically. I'm a huge Barack Obama fan, but that doesn't matter. The point is, you get the sense that there are certain people who are, their intellect and their life experience made them have to use their intellect in a way that they learned how to decipher systems and systems of human interaction and behavior so that they could harness it in a way. And so, I've been fascinated by this for not my whole life, but for a long time. And look, I grew up in a house where my dad had poker chips and he gambled too much, and separately on sports. I mean, and conversations about whether one could really have an edge were conversations that certainly like happened. But I have a question for you, which is, what's the extent of your ability to turn it off? Like, someone who spent so much time studying the way humans reveal themselves, the ways they try to resist revealing themselves, the way they use themselves for advantage or not. I just would imagine that a lot of interactions that you have become kind of freighted with this knowledge you pick up, whether you want to or not. Or is it, okay, I'm tuning in or I'm not tuning in? How does that function for you?
Yeah, I think it's, I'd say that I'm quite humble about, you know, real world applications of these things. Like there are certain things I will get clues from, but a lot of the times, you know, there's a lot of noise in real world things where it's hard to say, oh, did they say it for this reason, this reason, this reason. So, and I've written about that too, of like, there's a lot of these, you know, so-called behavior experts who will like spout off confidently about like, oh, what does it mean when they said such and such or did such and such in a interrogation or interview setting. But I think in a lot of those cases, it's just, you know, there can be a lot of noise and a lot of ambiguity. But I think, you know, I do pick up, you know, good clues. And I've actually thought about writing a book or something about like little clues and like kind of like workplace or, you know, colleague intercommunications. Because I do see a good amount of that kind of stuff interpersonally and like professionally and stuff. But I think, you know, the times that you're certain about that stuff are kind of few and far between. And oftentimes it's kind of like poker too, where it's kind of just supporting something you already kind of guessed, or there wouldn't be that much, you know, amazing insight behind it anyway. But I do think the verbal stuff is really powerful. I like to tell people, you know, if you're really interested in understanding behavior and getting information out of it, reading stuff like Mark McClish's book, I Know You're Lying, which is about interpreting verbal statements, hidden meanings in verbal and written statements, is that stuff's just much more powerful than like trying to use nonverbal physical behavior. A quick note here that I have a previous episode, one of the most popular ones, where I interview Mark McClish about searching for hidden meaning in statements. Back to the talk. But yeah, it's and it's also just something too, where like I'm not going to, you know, it's kind of like a politeness too. Like it wears you out to also to think about it too much too. There's a few reasons why you just may not be always on and thinking about it at full bore or such.
Yeah. Because people lie so much. And if you go through life constantly looking, sometimes they're lying because they think it's the kinder thing to do. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they're lying because they can't bring themselves to have to face whatever it is, you know? And I just imagine if you're someone who's studied this the way you have, it might be at times, and this gets to what you're answering away. Like, I'm fascinated, like when you're a writer of the kind that I am, right? I'm always trying to look through other people's eyes. I'm always trying to empathize through their point of view. And so I'm thinking about if I had the skill set that your hard won skill set, I'm thinking about what it must be like. You know, it's like the way I've studied con artists, I can sometimes see things coming. And then it's also like people, I think often we as humans don't want to necessarily, let's say you can divine, you know, someone you like says, hey, I have a special invitation I want to give you to something. And you want to believe it's a special invitation. You don't want to believe that they're bringing you there because it's going to serve them or their need, or there's a, right? I mean, you're laughing because like you've had, you know, and like it's easier to just think, oh, isn't that sweet?
Right. You don't want to know. Yeah. You don't want to delve too deep in people's.
Yeah. You want to go like, oh, it's sweet that they thought of me, instead of going like, oh, special invitation. I know what that means, you know? And so like, it's easier to just kind of flow through. Right. And, so I don't know. I'm so character wise, people who are going to be vigilant with themselves. So, and say, no, you know what? I'm going to do the hard work of that kind of vigilance because the enterprise needs that. And then they get certainty too. Cause like you're 100% right, man. Often the information's faulty. Often, you know, someone could say those, what's McClish is the guy, like someone could say three McClish buzzwords and actually not be fucking lying. And right. The good player knows to take a step back and look at the, I heard those words. What that should do is awaken you. It shouldn't, right? That should awaken you. Now take a look. Now put all the other elements together as opposed to just going, oh, that guy's full of shit. So,
and like in real life too, you have to weigh the risks, the dangers of being wrong, right? You have to like, if I think, you know, this might make it more likely, like what, you know, like for example, if I think somebody said something in real life, non-poker situation, and it made me think that they're not telling the truth, there could be major downsides to like accusing someone of lying, right? Like, so you have to think about, you know, what is the actual usefulness, even if you suspect it may be true, these kinds of things. Yeah.
Yeah. It's funny. We're not doing this on video, but I happen to be wearing, a very old, I bet you this is a 17-year-old, and it looks it's all beat up, really old, full tilt poker hat. I would say if we were on video, I was going to say to you, like, it's a perfect kind of thing. Cause what is it? It could have no meaning wearing that hat to someone who's in the world of poker. It could mean, I don't really know the significance of what they did and who got hurt. It could mean, I'm telling you, I don't give a fuck about, like, and I was like going to say, it's like one of those things where, or it could literally just be, I grabbed a hat that's been in my closet and I didn't even look at the hat I put on my head.
Right. What does it signal?
Yeah. Right. It could signal a lot of different, like wearing that hat to someone in the, basically like wearing this hat in the world to the gym is meaningless, but wearing the hat talking to someone in the world of poker is meaningful or could be meaningful. And I was going to ask you about it. So the answer is I'm fascinated by this shit is why I write about it. Cause it's like, semiotics are fascinating, man, and especially figuring out what the semiotic signal is and who's aware of iconography and who's not aware of it in all sort of ways, you know?
And I think it gets back to something you said about the, you know, it's good to be a bit humble and not be overconfident in these things because, like we said, there can be so many meanings. So I think in the real world context, there's a real value to, you know, sitting back and being like, well, I'm not going to form any really confident, reach any confident conclusions without good reason. Because yeah, there just can be so much noise in these things. And it can make you a bit neurotic to, start thinking like, oh, I'm going to definitely be able to be a Sherlock Holmes and pull out all these, you know, minute, conclusions, right. About things that I could,
yeah,
convince myself are right, but I'm.
Yeah, I was reading something the other day where someone said, someone I like, someone I respect, wrote a post, I think, about, you know, how to tell if you're not in a good game, basically. Like, how do you know if you're maybe sitting with people? And they said, and I thought it was really great, they said, you know, just because they're wearing a hoodie and glasses doesn't necessarily mean
they're a pro.
It could mean they've just watched TV. But then one of the other things was the way they handle chips. And like, I'm not sure because a lot of people play now in enough poker that they know how to handle chips.
Right. They can riffle them and such. Yeah.
You know, I mean, I could do a lot with chips. Like I can really riffle them. I mean, if you sat with me to poker player, you would know I've played thousands of hours of poker, but that I don't know that that would tell you that I'm a winning poker player or what level winning poker player. Maybe it would just make you pay a little bit of attention to me. What would it tell you though, if you sat at a table, as I want to know, and some dude or woman was wearing what was very clearly a really weather-beaten, beat up, full tilt poker had? Like, what would you imagine? What would you sort of ascribe anything to it?
It's getting back to that, some of the things we talked about. Like you said, there could be multiple interpretations. Like, I mean, I think the thing I would jump to immediately is like, they've probably been playing for a while. Like no matter what that tells you, I mean, they could have got it at a thrift store. Sure. But it's probable that they've been playing for a while. Like, but again, like you're saying, does that mean they're good? Or maybe they just, you know, lost a bunch of money on Full Tilt back in the day and they're still bad. I don't know.
Right.
Yeah. It's hard to reach conclusions sometimes.
Yeah. But also you might be able, like there might be information in that. And it's, I don't know. That's why I find all this stuff.
Yeah.
Incredible. And I think, you know, House of Games, I don't want to downplay it. Like, you know, House of Games, like, you know, the ring and the fact that the ring was a fake, you know, that like the whole first sequence of that, and anyone listening to this should watch that movie, David Mamet's House of Games. I mean,
it's great.
And even though the poker's kind of bullshitty intentionally or whatever, the way that they talk about that stuff, you know, I think I saw that movie in college and it was like, oh, this is important. Because I was already playing so much poker and I was already so interested, but I for sure hadn't found Book of Tells yet. I found Book of Tells a couple of years later. I found Doyle's book maybe right after, and that had some stuff about how to read people. It was more the mythical thing. And I think I'm 57 years old. So like back then when I was in college, I think most people would assume if someone looked you in the eyes, they had the hand, you know? And of course now it's all changed. You really still have to figure out if the person's been trained, if they've read. It still works, by the way, that I will say to, like that one, Caro's one thing, which was just, you know, often people will look away if they have a hand and look at you if they're bluffing, if they're not intentionally showing you that, if they're not educated, if they don't know, that does, I've had that pay ever since that moment when I was young. I can't tell you the number of times that's paid off for me. Once you can figure out if the person's doing it, you know, how many steps away from the idiot they think you are, basically.
A quick note here. I didn't want to get too in the weeds on this during the talk and interrupt Brian and I's discussion, but I did want to mention that I do think eye contact after betting is a pretty complex area of behavior, more complex than what Mike Caro wrote about. I actually think the reverse pattern is more common. Someone making a big bet who's willing to stare at you and make eye contact with you is more tied to relaxation and a strong hand than it is to bluffing. But there can, of course, be different patterns, and it's also possible that the pattern Mike Caro talked about, the opposite pattern of staring at people when bluffing, may be more common in certain player pools or maybe more common in the past. The most complete description of what I think about eye contact can be found in my final Poker Tells book, Exploiting Poker Tells. Okay, back to the talk. So I was curious, I was reading something about your decision, how you decided to work on rounders. And maybe the article was wrong because it made it sound like you didn't actually know that much about poker or hadn't played that much before then. And you just thought that maybe poker would make a really good
subject. That's 180 degrees wrong.
Okay. Yeah. That's not surprising. I read so many wrong things online. So I was like, I based on what you were just saying, I was like, well, that's got to be wrong because it sounded like you were pretty familiar with poker when you decided to write rounders.
I've written about this before, but when I was 8 years old, I was at sleepaway camp. And there's this word, it doesn't mean what it sounds like, this word canteen, but it doesn't mean like a canteen you drink out of. Like canteen is where you could buy things like candy and stuff. And then your parents would give you money that was your canteen money for the whole summer. I don't know, was it $12 or $9, whatever it was back then, $20. But you had access to that money, but it was for this one purpose and it would be kept in an envelope. And this bunk that I was in at camp, a bunch of these dudes play poker. My dad, because he like had these chips in the house, he had a carousel of chips in the house, but he didn't play poker much back then, more sports betting. But these bunkmates of mine knew how to play and we played and I got cleaned out. I lost the whole canteen, my whole canteen money gone. And it upset me so much that I was like, I got to learn what the fuck this game is. And so I pursued poker a lot and in various ways over a long period of time. It was in my 20s when in college we played my senior year every day. We ended up playing a lot of hearts. That's why hearts got in rounders in that one scene in the jail. But we were playing a lot of hearts and also poker. And I learned really valuable lessons then because this one friend of mine was better And we played gin a lot, but then I went and read some gin books. And when I got better, he stopped playing against me. And I was like, oh, that's amazing. I don't have that discipline. You know, he was a really good gambler. And he was just like, oh, Koppelman got better than me at gin. So that's an activity we're not doing. And I would not have had that capacity at all back then. I did not have that kind of self-control as a 19-year-old. Not nearly, you know. No, I was so into – this is the way the story got conflated, I think. So I loved poker and I was in the record business, you know, and I was, I got married young and I married the right person. And so a certain kind of activity was, if I was on a business trip, was off limits for me and happily off limits, but still there was time. And I found the bike and I found commerce. And I just started going to those places when I was 26 years old, 25, 24. So I was in those places all the time. And it was amazing that that existed. Yet David and I had not yet started. So when I was at Commerce in the bike, so let's say I was in LA, I would go play. And that's when I started reading, you know, poker books. But then a friend of mine, I was in 1995, the end of 1995. I know the date, December 15th, 1995. I was with a friend and I was telling him how much I love playing poker in LA. I was in New York, back in New York. And a guy I work with said, well, you know, there are these underground clubs in New York. And I said, I've always heard about it and wanted to go, but I have no contacts or connects, so I don't know. And he said, there's this guy who tangentially is in our business too, but really he helps manage the Mayfair Club, which is this club on 24th Street, and I can get you in. Hmm. And that was at a lunch on that day. And that night I went. And this part's the part that you heard. So I go to the Mayfair, but not as a screenwriter. I go to the Mayfair because I can't believe that this exists. I sit down with this guy, Joel Bagels, and I'm playing the first night. I played stud at first. And the way they spoke, I lost all the money I had. I went, you know, maxed out my ATM card, like $700 or something. Like I brought like... I don't know, maybe I brought $400 and then I lost another $350 or so. At the time, I wasn't going to take credit from them or, you know, I wasn't going to, whatever. And I did leave there and call David. By then, we'd been talking about trying to find something to write. And I did leave there and say, I know what the movie we're going to write is. Because we were already going to write about these two kids. We already had Worm. Worm's based on a guy I went to college with. And they were going to be gamblers of some sort. And we already had the scene where the Mike character's name was Matt, then goes and finds Worm in a gym because I used to go to a gym in the middle of the night, break in to shoot baskets to clear my head. Mm. And that was something we'd always thought about. And so we had this idea. But when I went to the poker club, that was when I was in. And Dave was like, well, okay, but now we got to really dive in. Who are the characters? What do they want? Mm. And that's when the process started. Mm-hmm. But I was so into plan that I just, you know, it was 2 years of like living at the Mayfair Club, basically. Mm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I wanted to talk a little bit about this this blog post I wrote 10 plus years ago about tells and rounders, and I'll just describe it a little bit for people listening. So everyone knows about the Oreo cookie tell and rounders, Teddy KGB opening the Oreos, indicating he has a strong hand. But there were some other behaviors and rounders that were common tells that weren't at the center of the plot. So in this blog post of mine, I talked about examples of what I've referred to as disclaimers, which I later called misdirections in my book, Verbal Poker Tells. Basically, these were verbal statements that misdirect attention away from someone's true reason for doing something. So, for example, at one point, the main character, Mike, says, yeah, I'm going to go all in because I don't think you got the spades. So he's implying he's going all in mainly because he thinks KGB did not make the flush, when actually Mike's got a very strong hand. So he's misdirecting attention away from the real reason for him going all in. So another way to think about this is that it's basically Mike Caro's, you know, weak means strong, strong means weak patterns. And I don't know if we mentioned it. Yeah, Mike Caro's book makes a cameo in your in Rounders. I wanted to throw that in there too. So there were a few more instances of that kind of misdirection in Rounders. And one thing I was curious about when I wrote that blog post was whether, you know, if you were kind of aware of that at the time and just thought that, you know, we need to obviously have them talk in entertaining, dramatic ways with each other, you know, to hell with like whether that's a common, people might perceive that as a poker tell, or else were you maybe, was it maybe something you thought about afterwards and you're like, oh, that's actually something that is a common poker tell that happens a lot. Would you care to share your thoughts on all that?
Well, I would say if you go back one step further, why did Mike write about that? Why is that a thing that exists? It's because it's a thing people do. Not now, not in 2024, but in a pre-internet world, people behaved. They just behaved how they behaved. They spoke how they spoke. They tried to gain advantage when they could gain advantage in those settings. And saying something like, I don't think you got spades, it's, as you know, it's actually depends on how many, it's Yardley, right? It depends on how many steps away from the idiot I think you are. So he could be trying to communicate to Teddy KGB, it doesn't matter what you have, man, you could have the flush. I still can beat you because I have a full house. Like, it could be a very sophisticated bluff. That can be a bluff if you know the other person is hip to what you might be doing, right? So it's, look, the idea, I mean, we had read, I'll say like, at the time I was talking to the person who owned the Gambler's Bookshop in LA, I mean, in Vegas all the time. And I was reading, I have this collection of books, I'm staring at it now. It's a giant collection of poker books still, many of which are from back then. And so, yeah, we were reading all that stuff and figuring out the ways people talked. And also we were in the Mayfair Club and the Diamond Club and the VFW Hall and writing down shit that people said and watching it. So yeah, some of the dialogue is obviously torqued up. Nobody said three stacks of high society, not since 1911, but the idea of the ways in which people communicate, the ways in which people signal strength. I mean, yeah, we were conscious of that, but also conscious of the utility of seeming to signal that you're revealing a tell when in fact you're doing something else. It's just that Teddy had the one hand that it didn't matter what the fuck Mike had, because quads aren't on the table because Mike has one of each, right? So Teddy had the only hand better than Mike.
A quick note here. Again, I didn't want to bother Brian about it during our talk, but I'll just say that I do think the verbal statements and rounders that I wrote about in my blog post show up like many standard and reliable and common verbal poker tells that you'll find amongst a fairly mediocre player pool. Of course, anything is possible. As Brian says, experienced poker players might say such things in real life. I'm just talking about common patterns. And in this case, some of the behaviors I write about in rounders are just standard weak means strong behaviors, what I call weak hand statements in my book, Verbal Poker Tells. Weak hand statements are when players say things that weaken their range in various ways, indirectly or directly. You actually don't find even good players switching this pattern up much. This pattern for weak hand statements is quite reliable. Surprisingly reliable, actually, once you really tune into them. And the degree of subtlety is a big factor here. When I say that the verbal poker tells and rounders are good examples of commonly found tells from bad players, what I mean is that the behaviors are fairly over the top and obvious. In the hand we were talking about, when the Mike character acted stressed out and said, time, like you needed more time to think, and then said, I don't think you have the spades, and went all in, it was just quite over the top in terms of trying to act quite weak and uncertain. That's what I was trying to communicate in my blog post. Not that such behaviors couldn't be found from very good players or couldn't be switched up, but just that the very unsubtle presentation of them made them seem like the behaviors you'd find from fairly inexperienced players. If you're interested to learn more about why I think these things, I'd recommend checking out my book, Verbal Poker Tells. A lot of that book actually deals with the concept of weak hand statements and the different ways they show up. Actually, kind of funny, related to that, there's a hand from the 2009 World Series of Poker where Matt Damon does some very similar over-the-top behaviors, acting very stressed out and uncertain, when he flops a full house. Matt Damon's behavior in that hand basically, to me, gives away how inexperienced at poker he is. And it reminds me of his character's behavior in rounders, if that helps explain it a little better, what I mean. In the blog post for this episode's entry, I'll include some links to these resources I've mentioned. And sorry to Brian for all this post-interview disagreement and digression. I didn't want to hold up our interview too much, but I did want to dig into this topic a little bit more because I thought poker players would find it interesting and because I wanted to defend the ideas in my blog post a little bit more. Okay, back to the talk. So I actually didn't know how many interviews you would have done for your podcast the moment I saw that you'd interviewed more than 400 people and you had so many interesting people in there. And I was actually reading some reviews of your podcast people had written, and somebody said that they thought that you were maybe one of the best interviewers in the country just because of how you've gotten so many people to talk openly and be vulnerable about their life, these kinds of things. So I'm curious, how do you feel about your skills as an interviewer? Have you seen them get a lot better over time since you started that endeavor?
So this is a good thing to talk about. I would say I don't spend that much time in general. I do when I'm like weightlifting, but other than that, I spend that much time in general or like a tennis, I guess, sports, but trying to fix myself at a point in a graph and sort of evaluate that. Instead, I would rather say, okay, I feel like that interview wasn't great. Why? I wasn't curious enough about the person I was interviewing. Next time I should make sure that I'm only interviewing people about whom I have great curiosity. Because when I'm really curious, when I'm really fascinated, the interview is going to be great because it's going to feel like a conversation and everyone's going to hear that I can't believe how lucky I am that I get to engage in this. And that's really, it's really outwardly directed. It's really directed at inward. It's very inward in that it's like, does this, the notion of having this conversation fire me up in a way that it's worth it to put in the work I have to put in to do a great job.
Right. You got to find the thread.
And that's really what I'm thinking about. Mm-hmm. I mean, it really is. I'm just thinking about the amount of work I have to do. Because I will not phone in an interview. I will not fake the funk. I'll read the fucking books and I'll listen to the thing and I'll watch the thing. And so I have to be fascinated by somebody's, either by their story, their work, the life that they've lived, something they've said. Mm-hmm. And so the most important thing is guest selection. The most important thing at being a good interviewer in a podcast scenario is guest selection. If you have the right guest for you, then the interviews will be great. Mm-hmm. And if you don't, it's very hard. Then you have to just be, look, my whole life, I try to put myself in a position where I'm working from a place of curiosity and fascination. I said yes to this because I'm really fascinated by your work and the way you think. And so I knew, well, it doesn't matter. I could be on either side of this conversation. It's a conversation I want to have. I basically say no to, I don't know, some number like 75% of the podcast requests to beyond podcasts. I mean, I mostly just say no. Mm-hmm. Because I've gotten to it. That wasn't my policy 10 years ago, but I'm a little talked out now. So I would just rather not do it. I don't need –
You need the spark. Yeah,
I get very little out of this kind of thing except the engagement with the person I'm talking to.
Well, to your point, I've had that learning too, where I've said I'd interview people for my podcast mainly to like be nice or because I was doing it for other people, and then those are the ones that always turn out the worst for me. Like you said, it's like you got to have that spark and really want to ask some specific questions. Yeah,
yeah, totally right. You do. You have to like feel. Yeah, you have to feel engaged. I mean, of course, everyone's been in a situation where they've done something to be kind. And by the way, that's a valid, really valid thing. But the product won't be amazing. And you got to say to yourself, well, sometimes that's a balancing. But I don't do it. I can't. I like got to a point where I would rather not do any. I mean, I have to be engaged or it's not worth it. And you know, it's back to what I love about poker. When I sit at the poker table, I'm never bored. I've never been bored at a poker table. Mm-hmm.
Always something to watch and observe. And
and I don't understand. I get it. I don't understand. We all do it, but like, I'm not on my phone when I'm at the poker table. You know, it's the same thing. Honestly, like I've become the last six, seven months, I've become really like crazily obsessed with lifting weights and learning about it and figuring it out. And I think one of the things is when you're doing sets to failure, you truly are forced to be present and you're engaged in something where you're trying to improve and you've kind of like everything, you have to bring everything to bear in that moment, you know? And poker done the right way, I think it's the same thing. Yes, you're having conversation. Yes, you're with your friends. Yes, it's great. Yes, there are laughs. But, you know, can you stay alert during that? Can you stay focused? Can you stay curious? Can you stay engaged? Can you keep listening? Can you pick something up? And, you know, as you state in your books, you might not pick up a sign for a whole night of poker. You could still win, by the way. You still play well. And you might not really hear the thing that makes you make a certain, or you might even not be in, you know, you might, like, the moment you can really tell somebody's like has it or doesn't have it, you might not even be in that fucking hand. Mm-hmm. But you learn it for next time. So it's not that different. It's like everything I do, I try to make be something that I can be that, have that level of engagement.
Are you going to write a rounders for weightlifting? Is that a script idea?
It's tough. There's an angle at it, but you know, there, by the way, I mean, talk about subcultures.
Dude. Yeah. There is a,
dude, I mean, that's a subculture that is so intense. I mean, the arguments that people in the world of lifting have with each other mm-hmm. about literally, you could get guys calling each other the worst, smart guys with like PhDs calling each other the worst names ever about like 5 to 7 reps versus 10 to 12 reps. I mean, literally, you could have people call, like, you know, devoting hours of podcast to just downvoting somebody who thinks that, you know, a 5-set range is worse than a 10-set range. It's amazing. And this thing, I had no idea of the wars about that until I got into mm-hmm. it, you know, no different than starting. No different than starting hand arguments right. Or position arguments. I mean, it's the same thing.
Do you mind if I ask you about transcendental meditation?
I'm totally happy. I love talking about it. Yep.
I know that you're a big proponent of that. And I was wondering if you explained it to a lay audience, what are the, how would you pitch it? What are the benefits that you get from it?
Like Tim Ferriss says, you know, I think he said something along these lines. I'm paraphrasing, I'm not quoting him. That like, it might be the thing that is most in common among the guests that he's had on his show is that they do some form of meditation. Mm. I think I started meditating in 2011. And it's, I want to say this succinctly. For me, the benefit is it reduced the physical manifestations of anxiety by something like 80 or 85%.
Wow.
And, you know, one of the things is that when people want to sell stuff, they'll say it makes your anxiety disappear. And we as human beings go, well, that's bullshit. Because nothing can, because we're humans and we know we're mortal. So we have anxiety. But it just made the physical manifestations, the stomach or the heart, that, you know, it just suddenly, quickly, a month in, that stuff just went way, the volume just went way down on it. And that alone, enough. Then clarity of thought, peacefulness, sense of well-being. It's, look, exercise, I'm, you know, talking about lifting, but I've always been someone who exercises a lot. And part of why I started like lifting and stuff is because as you get older, if you let yourself stay out of shape, but you still play sports really hard, you can just hurt yourself all the time. And, you know, if you're fat, like I was, it's just bad. So I had to start, then you throw the cardio piece in and you're like, well, I got to do the other thing too. So like, but so exercise has always been meditative too for me. I can get to that sort of alpha state that they call it, you know, meditation is 20 minute. The way I do it, transcendental meditation, TM, there's a book by David Lynch, the great filmmaker. The book is called Catching the Big Fish. And he talks about it in a way that I find incredibly compelling, but essentially you're repeating a nonsense word to yourself quietly in your brain,
your mantra
for 20 minutes and, twice a day. And, it's very easy. And it's very calming. I just feel better doing it. I had a lot of questions going in. I had read all the sort of negative things about TM and I was very aware of it. I had very clear rules for myself about the ways in which I would engage. You know, I would go take these lessons and then that's the extent of my involvement. And it's been, by the way, the extent I've never gone on some retreat or didn't. That. It's just I find this technique useful. And I'm just always after like whatever can make, look, it's hard being a person. And so whatever makes being a person a little bit easier, I'll take. And because, you know, it goes back to the thing I said about mortality and, you know, we understand people are fragile. It means the people you love are fragile. And that stuff's scary sometimes. So anything that'll help, I'm interested in. And exercise is a huge one. Walking, not just as exercise, but, you know, walking is really helpful. Mm-hmm. Journaling is helpful, I think. And I think transcendental meditation, for me, very useful.
So does the form of the meditation, is it always the same? So it's 20 minutes of repeating the mantra, and it doesn't vary from that.
Yeah, but you don't, but the thing is, like, when you learn TM, it's not a rigor. It's not a rigid. It's not rigid. You're not forcing yourself to say this mantra over and over again. You're allowing this mantra to surface, and you're kind of like engaging with it. And then sometimes your thoughts come in, and it's like other meditation you've heard before. Your thoughts come in, and then your thoughts move out, and the mantra mm-hmm. resurfaces. And it's just being in that space. And I'll say, like, I will not play. So I do the morning meditation every single day of my life. Like, I haven't missed one since 2011. And I'd say I do the one in the afternoon 70-80% of the time. Depends on period. Right now I'm in a period of time where I'm doing it every day. But sometimes, like, life makes it hard to do the second one. But I will never play poker at night without doing this. Like, never. Mm-hmm. It's a zero for me. If I will – maybe I did it twice and I just know. So, like, when I will meditate this afternoon before I go play poker tonight, for sure. And that will be useful. It will reset me in a way. Doesn't mean I'm going to win, by the way. I get to lose.
And you said it was it's something you say internally. You don't say it out loud. Is that right?
Correct. You never say it out loud. Yeah.
Is your mantra a secret, or can you say what it is?
No, you don't say what it is. And the reason is you don't want to attach anything to it. It's a word, sound, noise. You don't want to attach someone's reaction. You don't want to attach that moment. It really is just something to break the cycle of the pattern of thoughts.
You don't want association.
No, you don't want any. Yeah. No one knows it. And it's not because it's like some state secret. It's not a special. It's because it keeps you pristine.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And what do you have your own thoughts on what the mechanism is by how it helps you? Is it basically like, because you said, you know, these other thoughts come in and you basically are able to kind of brush them aside. Do you think it kind of sets you up to be more easily able to brush aside anxiety?
I don't know. Like, I was reading a book. This is not transcendent. This is a way to get to the answer. I was reading, I think, a book by Thich Nhat Hanh, who's this amazing Buddhist. And he had this phrase that he said he repeated to himself, and he found it very useful. And I've done this not as TM, because it's not TM, but I've done this sometimes to go to bed at night if it's I somehow not able to fall asleep and my thoughts racing. And he says, I am not my body. I'm not even my mind. And by repeating that to himself, not out loud, it's a reminder in a way that the thoughts you think aren't necessarily valid. We all have thought things that we didn't put into action or that turned out to be wrong, fears, right? And so just reminding yourself, yeah, you might feel a twinge in your knee, but you are not the twinge in your knee. It's useful. Anything to create a tiny bit of separation from the thoughts that kind of own us most of the time and our essential nature, any way that we can sort of separate those slightly, I think has tremendous benefit. And I think TM, though I don't know, I really don't know the answer to this, but like what it feels like to me is that there's probably a cycle of like counterproductive thoughts that we all have. Who knows where they're from? Who knows when we took them on? Whether they're worries, fears, self-criticism, whatever the thing is, the mantra has a way of like, if that thing is a circle, that's just going and going, and then maybe the mantra just kind of like takes us somewhere else away from that and breaks it so that you have a minute to just have some peace.
Yeah, that makes sense. It's like breaking the rumination or the ruts that we get into our normal.
I would say people should get
ruts.
Yeah, exactly right. Ruts. People should look at, I mean, there's, a lot of EEG studies and stuff, brainwave studies, and they're doing more and more. Like there are a lot of science now on this question. I was even reading recently. I put into two different of the AI engines a bunch of questions about meditation, the various forms, and about whether what the science said. And I was really prepared to be told that it's all been debunked, but it just hasn't been. Like the science really stands up for its benefits, and you can just find that out. Like that's just out there, people looking at the brainwaves and stuff.
Yeah. And like you said, it's, you know, there's some understandable mechanisms by which you can see it helping you. And it's not like some things you hear about, you're like, that makes no sense. Like, yeah, you can see the logic there. Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's been great talking to you. It's a big honor. I've always enjoyed your work. I always look forward to what you're working on next. So thanks a lot for talking to me.
Thank you. And as I said at the beginning, and I mean it, your work is valuable. I'm really glad that you're doing it. I often wish you were just sitting next to me at a poker table so you could tell me what the fuck was going on, man, when I can't figure it out for myself.
Well, thanks, Brian.
All right, take care. Be well.
That was a talk with screenwriter, producer, and director Brian Koppelman. Brian is also the host of the podcast The Moment, where he's got some amazing interviews with some very interesting people. You can learn more about him at briankoppelman.com. If you're a poker player and enjoyed this talk, you might like some other poker-related talks I've done for the podcast. You can find a compilation of all the game and sports-related episodes on my site, peoplewhoreadpeople.com. And if you want to learn more about my PokerTells work, check out my site, readingpokertells.com. Thanks for listening. Music by Small Skies.